From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The First World War was so colossal and so savage that it was called the War to End All Wars. 9 million soldiers dead, maybe another 9 million civilians. The world's introduction to industrial mechanized warfare, trench warfare, and its horror. Nations sucked in and torn apart by their own alliances. For generations, historians described World War I as more or less inevitable, unavoidable. But was it? My colleague, Jack Beatty, has written a new history, a counterfactual take on how it might have been in the summer of 1914, how it might have gone. This hour, On Point, the road to war, to the Great War, World War I. World War I seems never to go very far away. War Horse, Steven Spielberg's movie, of course, very much about World War I. And Downton Abbey, the popular PBS miniseries as well. Trench warfare was a central feature of the First World War. Soldiers went over the top when they ran straight out of the trenches into machine gun and artillery fire, barbed wire, poison gas. Here's a scene from Downton Abbey. A British lieutenant orders his men to charge out of their trench and attack the Germans.
Back, back!
And into the mayhem and death there, the sound of World War I. Joining me now from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, longtime editor at The Atlantic, thinker, friend, author of Age of Betrayal and The Rascal King. His new book is The Lost History of 1914, Reconsidering the Year the Great War Began. Jack, welcome. It's wonderful to have you.
Hello, Tom. Thank you.
Take us back to just how big and how bad this war was. You're writing counterfactual history and options here, but just remind us of the scale of what happened to the world in this war.
Well, even today, the scale is incomprehensible. George Kennan, I think, without fear of contradiction, called World War I the great seminal catastrophe of the 20th century. Seminal because, of course, it left the world big with World War II, with communism in Russia, with fascism in Italy, Hitler. And really, I think one of the best ways to gain a sense of it, here is Hannah Arendt, some sentences from her, I think, that really give the sense of it. It is almost impossible, even now, to describe what happened in Europe on August 4, 1914, the days before and the days after the First World War are separated not like the end of an old and the beginning of a new period, but like the day before and the day after an explosion. Yet this figure of speech is as inaccurate as all the others, because the quiet of sorrow which settles down after a catastrophe has never come to pass. The first explosion seems to have touched off a chain reaction in which we have been caught up ever since, and which nobody seems to be able to stop. Hannah Arendt.
As big as that, as seminal a catastrophe as that, in Kennan's words, not far from people we saw just recently. I think the last known surviving veteran of World War I died just within the last month or so. She was 110 years old. And in the front of your book, Jack, you have a photograph, apparently, of your own father here, John J. Beatty, who was in this war and whose ship was hit in the Bay of Biscay.
Yes, and my dedication is that I was born in the last year of World War II, but I raised on memories of World War I. My father really told me stories of London under bombardment by German dirigibles, of a pub brawl between American soldiers and sailors and English soldiers. You're 4 years late, Yank.
Yeah.
Of mustering the nerve to ask a posh parish lady for a kiss, and of course of the 36 flag-draped coffins of his shipmates from the USS Mount Vernon, torpedoed by a German submarine in the Bay of Biscay, arraigned along a Brest dock, and the captain weeping during the memorial service and the tears soaking his blouse.
Jack, remind us of the story, and many of us will just know it, but the kind of version of how and why this war began that we are more or less taught in school. You know, the Archduke's assassination. And give us, you push back in many ways, in many really interesting directions here, and we will explore them. But give us kind of the canned popular understanding of the beginning of this war.
I think that that it was really given by the perpetrators of the war. After the war, in their memoirs and even in their official histories, the picture was conveyed that the war was inevitable. It was like one leader said, a sudden storm that swept everything before it. Lloyd George, the British leader, said that we slithered over the brink. We had no control over events. And this view of the war as an inevitability of the alliance systems, triple entente, triple alliance, that these forces just, you know, like sort of doomsday machines pushing the countries to war, the leaders reluctantly to war. This was really this line was put out by Germany during the 1920s. They were desperate, the Germans were, to get out from under the Versailles Treaty and its reparations. And one way to do it was to say, we didn't do it. We're not responsible for this war. It was a great accident. It was a catastrophe. Strangely, that interpretation of events lasted almost up until into the 1960s, generally. Mm-hmm. You can read Barbara Tuchman's classic Guns of August from 1962, and it's still there. We slithered over the brink. But then in the 1960s, under a great German historian, Fritz Fischer, wrote a series of books in which he basically said, no, the war was chosen. The war was chosen from Berlin. They wanted it. They wanted it in Vienna. There was nothing inevitable about it. This wasn't an accident. This wasn't a storm. This was a conspiracy to break the peace of Europe. And this created a tremendous row. But to this day, that is the understanding of the war. The war was desired. So next to the paradigm of inevitable war, we have today the paradigm of desired war.
A desired war or chosen, but that's not the way it was put forward, as you write, according to the Austrian chief of staff, Konrad von Hötzendorf, saying, the First World War came about inevitably and irresistibly as the result of the motive forces in the lives of states and peoples, like a thunderstorm which must by its nature discharge itself, almost an act of God, as it described there, Jack.
Yes, and he was a hell of a one to use that kind of image. What was his motive for wanting the war? He wanted to impress his mistress. His diaries make clear. He was 67, I think. He was in love with a 28-year-old woman who was married to the beer magnate of Austria-Hungary. And Hötzendorf thought, oh, my God, if I can come back laureled with triumph, I'll sweep her off her feet. The emperor will get me a divorce from Rome, and life will be bliss. So here he is talking about, you know, the war as a summer storm, and really it was these grotesquely selfish motives on his part that made him want war.
Give us then. We're going to explore your counterfactuals, the ways it might have gone. But what's your big take on this, Jack? I mean, it may apply to many wars. It may apply to us right now. But your big take on why this war got off the ground and how it might have gone otherwise, what, a series of choices by individuals?
A series of choices by, a couple of years ago, Cambridge University Press published a series of essays called Decisions for War, and scholars looked at the decisions in all the capitals. Their conclusion, coteries, groups of 6 to 10 people chose the war. The people were not involved, that is, the masses. Secret treaties bound Austria and Germany, France and Russia, England and France. At no point was the Demos consulted about these treaties, and the decision for war in each capital, in every capital, made by just a handful of men, some for the lowest kind of motives, to escape from political dilemmas, to, the Austro-Hungarians, for example, wanted to try to amalgamate their empire in war before it broke apart in nationalism. It was small groups of men, coteries, the people left out.
But the people, the Demos, as you say, I mean, they were the ones who fought it. They were the ones who died in the millions. Of course, there were all kinds of upper class officers out there in the trenches as well. But that 9 million, that was the people. But they really didn't have a voice in the decision. It almost sounds like Ron Paul these days. Do not go to war without everybody signing on.
Precisely. And it was bypassed public opinion in every case. And the usual view, of course, is the public was panting for war, eager. Historians now have challenged that. Yes, in the cities. Yes, among the chattering classes. Yes, among intellectuals. But not out in the out where the real people lived in Germany and England. The war was just a kind of fate that happened to these people. There was no enthusiasm for it.
And of course, it was presented as to many as, well, this will be over quickly, over maybe by Christmas, what started in the summer.
Before the leaves fall from the trees, the Kaiser said, you'll be home.
Jack, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with our own Jack Beatty about the Great War, World War I, and how it all might have been different, how it might have never happened, how wars really began. Jack Beatty's new book is The Lost History of 1914, Reconsidering the Year the Great War Began. Jack, here's a little bit of, just to give a flavor of how people were talking as they went into it, at least in this fictional accounting. This is the movie version of All Quiet on the Western Front, made into a film in 1930. That's the year before Hitler came to power. Early in that story, a patriotic German high school teacher, here he is urging his students to leave their studies and join the fight.
You are the knifers of fatherland, you boys. You are the iron men of Germany. You are the gay heroes who will repulse the enemy when you are called upon to do so. It is not for me to suggest that any of you should stand up and offer to defend his country. But I wonder if such a thing is going through your heads. I know that in one of the schools, the boys have risen up in the classroom and enlisted in a mass. And of course, if such a thing should happen here, you would not blame me for a feeling of pride.
They're from All Quiet on the Western Front. And, of course, Jack, after the war, you have Ernest Hemingway writing, putting in the mouth of his character Frederick Henry, the American volunteer ambulance driver, that after seeing what he saw there, he was always embarrassed by the words sacred, glorious, and sacrifice, a long way from that kind of speech in the days leading up to the war, Jack.
Yes, and that kind of speech, and if it had continued, we would have heard some nationalist comments about the greatness of Germany, the perfidy of Albion. That sort of thing, nationalistic education, was a big cause of the war. Our friend Steve Van Ever has written about this, showing how the textbooks, the materials were full of caricatures of the other, and great sort of overvaluations of one's own people. And we say to ourselves today, well, could there be any such echo as that? Well, of course, as you read the paper, it's hard to, and I'm glad, by the way, that A Separation, that Iranian movie, won an Academy Award, because here are real people in Iran, not the other. They're the people, the couple in this movie, who, mm-hmm. not this sort of, you know, other on whom we can project our fears.
And this director at the Academy Awards calling out for us to see each one another as humans, wherever we may live. All right, Jack, you've got a lot of counterfactuals proposed here. I wish you'd take us through some of them. You say it could have been otherwise. I don't know. Give us the circumstances. Maybe country by country, you know. Start where you will. Germany, Britain, Russia, the U.S. I mean, take us on your tour of how this and the century that followed, I suppose, might have gone differently.
Well, I take my motto from Herodotus, the father of history. He writes, very few things happen at the right time, and others do not happen at all. And in some ways, that's the moral of history. That's what history is. And what I try to show is that events within each of the belligerent countries in 1914, and of course with roots before then, mm-hmm. if only they had happened and unfolded at a different timing. If only, for example, Britain was threatened with civil war in Ireland, and I show how there was a kind of race between civil war there over home rule in Ireland and European war, and it came down to the last hours when finally, I think in the last day of July, war in Europe overtook civil war, but it was a near run thing. And I quote from the British General Staff telling Prime Minister Asquith that if the balloon goes up in Ireland and these private armies, these militias, Catholics in the South, Protestants in the North, if they start fighting, we're going to have to send everybody over there, all four divisions. We won't be able to send them to Europe. What will be the result? Well, here we have Neil Ferguson just flat out asserting, take those four divisions out of Europe in September 1914. Germany wins the Battle of the Marne, wins the war, and, quote, Hitler ends his days as a satisfied house painter in Central Europe.
So you've got the British Prime Minister, as you quote him, saying, expressing kind of relief that the war came quickly so that it could step in front of that Irish uprising. You quote him saying, God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders do perform. It was almost hallelujah about the war.
Almost. And some historians allege that the British welcomed the war and perhaps even wanted the war to escape from this domestic political disaster that was looming.
So what's your counterfactual then, Jack? I mean, you've got the Irish roots here, but are you saying bring on the uprising, bring on the Civil War, let that be the story instead of the Great War?
Yes, I do. I mean, far rather have that than what happened in, I mean, people would have died. There would have been terrible consequences. The consequences would not have included World War II.
What about on the German side? Was there any other way? I mean, after all, there was a lot of history at work here. There was the decades-old tension between the sort of militarists and more liberal Germans. Was there another way?
Well, yes, and Germany came close to an event that could have tipped it over. As I show, the army ran amok in a town, Zabern, in Alsace, arresting the people and, generally instituting what was called saber rule there. This created a tremendous row. The Reichstag, for the first time, actually the second time, but for the first time in a notable matter, censured the government, with the liberal parties voting with the dominant Social Democrats. This put the fear of losing their place in the world into the hearts of the German ruling class and stimulated there a powerful desire for a coup against the Reichstag. Shut the place down. Use this as an opportunity to finally deal with those Social Democrats. And as one German scholar puts it, their temptation was, if they had done that, they wouldn't have been in any position, even if they wanted war in August, they wouldn't have even been in a position to do it. They would have been so tied up suppressing the Social Democrats, who were the most numerous party, all over their country. Some historians think that their decision for war was a way to, quote, escape from this domestic political situation of every year more socialists, more liberals, fewer conservatives in the parliament, and eventually the road opening to a parliamentary democracy. So better escape forward into war than deal with that.
But what about there was also, as you write, the rise of Russia. Germany really feared that. This is interesting to us now when we watch China rising. I mean, Germany was afraid if they waited too long. Russia was already building railroads to Germany's borders. If they waited too long, Russia's power would be overawing. And so, like, do it now. What about that kind of dynamic that churns beneath these decisions?
That was a powerful one indeed. Bethmann Hollweg, the German chancellor, his son said to him, let's plant some trees on our estate. And Bethmann said, why bother? The Russians will be here in a couple of years anyway. And there was this kind of fatalism. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. And the Russians were recovering, of course, from their revolution of 1905. And every
not
year
not the growing. Revolution yet, but
I'm sorry,
not the revolution,
not
yet.
The revolution, right. But it's mm-hmm. preview of mm-hmm. 1905, mm-hmm. And the Germans were just deeply afraid that there would be the Russian bear, and they projected onto the Russians their own bellicosity. I mean, there was a kind of mirror imaging going on. we would attack if we had the opportunity, therefore they would. And of course, on the Russian side, you had nationalists, especially among the intellectuals, especially in the press, who were basically saying, look, we have this Teutonic ring forming around us. The Germans were sending military advisors to help the Turks in Constantinople, bottling Russia into the Black Sea, as that Russian spirit. We're surrounded by this Teutonic ring. We have to strike at it now before things are too late. And, of course, this is among just the intelligentsia, the vast millions of Russians not even knowing what Germany was.
But how do you, in your counterfactual view then, how might reality have worked against those? You can call them projections, you can call them, you know, even fantasies, but they were real at the time. What's the antidote?
The antidote, I think, would have been experience. And there's a very strong, I cite research and papers and so on, that the assassination of the Archduke was the all but unique precipitant of the war. That's because his assassination satisfied so many of the conditions necessary for a general war. Above all of them, his assassin was a Bosnian Serb, clearly connected to Serbian intelligence, was all the social democrats in Germany needed to hear. They were Russophobes. The Tsar was the great reactionary of the day. And once the connection was made to Russia through Serbia, they signed up for war credits. That was a crucial matter. And the argument is, if the Archduke hadn't been killed, and say somebody else there, the Governor General of Bosnia, who was riding in the car with him, had been, the Archduke would have argued Vienna out of war. His whole platform was no war, internal reform. We can't have war with Russia. So that removed him from the position. And historians see that there was a window of vulnerability really between 1914 and 1917, by when Russia would have completed, you mentioned, those strategic railways to the Polish-German border, that is, Russian Poland.
Right.
And once those were complete, some people think the German generals would have finally faced reality and said to the Kaiser, we can no longer fight a two-front war. Our old plan of defeating France first, and then while the lumbering Russian steamroller mobilizes and takes 40 days dealing with Russia, we won't be able to do that, because the Russians will be able to mobilize just as fast, get their troops to the borders just as fast, just as quickly as we can. So therefore, we'd better seek détente with Russia.
But the Archduke was killed. That fell apart. All kinds of response here. Jack Yar is listening. He says, I mean, it's amazing, a century nearly on, how vivid the history of this war remains. He writes, I grew up listening to stories about World War I from my grandfather. He drove a team of horses that pulled artillery. One of his tasks was to put gas masks on the horses when a mustard shell hit. He said you could tell a gas shell by the way it sounded as it exploded. One night when a shell hit, he was not able to get masks on the horses in time, and they all died. Another time an artillery shell hit within 3 feet of him but failed to explode. If it had, I wouldn't be here. Evansville, Indiana, James is calling. James, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Jack Beattie.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Jack. I'm so glad that you're having this conversation. I'm a history professor, and I'm working on a research project this semester that involves looking at the World War I memorials in Scotland. And I just wanted to make two quick points. The first is that there's a little village called Alvord in Aberdeenshire, small village, and on their war memorial there are seven pairs of brothers listed on that memorial. I just think that's a great illustration of where you began this morning, talking about the cost of war. You know, I spend my days just looking at hundreds of war memorials, and the cost to all of these individuals and their families is so striking.
What do you think about the notion of inevitability of this war?
Bear in mind when we look at another war. And the second point, just real quick, is, you know, you talked about All Quiet on the Western Front and the speeches about the enemy and so on before the war starts. But I think what war memorials teach us, too, is that the process of demeaning the enemy and giving virtue to the war and all that stuff, that's all part of memorialization as well. There's something like 50,000 war memorials around Britain alone, and they almost all have some message to the effect of the war was worthwhile, we were right, we were fighting, quote, for God, King, and country. I'm looking at one right now, which is in my mother's home village, tiny little village with a whole bunch of names on it, and it says on the memorial, in undying remembrance of our brave, through whose supreme sacrifice and service in the world's greatest war, our honor and liberty abide untarnished, and our homes inviolate. Death is swallowed up in victory. So you have, you know, religion and honor and patriotism and all these things all wrapped up in one. And I think when you have these memorials just as part of the landscape, it's really hard to sit down and think analytically about the causes of war in the way that Jack has done so well. Although I haven't read your book yet, Jack, but I fully intend to.
James, thank you. Thank you so much for that. Death is swallowed up in victory. And Jack, what are you thinking as you hear that? Because on the one hand, James is no doubt right. I mean, Goel writes online here, the Great War was a great classroom about the limits of nationalism. Nationalism took nations around the world to war almost without reason. On the other, Jack, would you, you know, these sacrifices that were made, once made, demand acknowledgement. Of course, I suppose the wrapping paper is an issue here, how they're wrapped.
That is the issue. And, you know, his James's reading the patriotic sentiments on that monument. Consider the last few lines of Wilfred Owen's great poem, Dulce et Decorum Est, It's Sweet to Die for One's Country. He talks about throwing a gas victim into a wagon. And he writes, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some distant glory the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori.
There is the sentiment and the cost vividly laid out. Jack, we're gonna dive on into your counterfactuals. We got to look at the American role in all this, not least. And we'll go to France as well. Jack Beatty writing in his new book about the beginnings of World War I, 1914. The book is The Lost History of 1914, Reconsidering the Year the Great War Began. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with Jack Beatty.
While you balloon pepper to light your fag, smile, boys, that's the style. What's the use of worrying? It never was worthwhile. So pack up, get some good in your own kit bag and smile, smile, smile.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour with our own Jack Beatty about his new book, The Lost History of 1914, Reconsidering the Year the Great War Began, asking if it might all have been different, asking if, how, it might never have happened. Here's a little bit from the 1981 film Gallipoli. It tells the story of a group of Australian soldiers fighting for the British Empire, invading modern-day Turkey, which was allied the Ottoman Empire with Germany. Pinned down by enemy troops during this 1915 battle, Australian forces ordered to attack, perilous uphill charge. Here's the commander of the Australian forces arguing with his superiors.
I've asked for confirmation from General Gard.
The orders are to attack, and you do so immediately. The British at Suvla must be allowed to get ashore. Is that clear? You are to push on.
It's cold-blooded murder.
I said push on.
Why, sir? Can't ask the men to do what I wouldn't do myself.
All right, men, we're going.
Push on, the order there, and they went to war. The world went to war. Jack, let's go to Chris in Moosup, Connecticut. Chris, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. And Jack, been listening and love to hear your voice talking about a book you wrote. I disagree with you. I think war is inevitable because we're in a aggressive species, I think Hitler still would have affected Germany. There's a lot of talk, and I don't know how you would bring in your book, but the British were just as militaristic as the Germans. I mean, if, especially people who watched Downton Abbey, the main character, his butler and him were buddies in the African wars. My grandfather told the story about his brother who couldn't wait to get into that war. He would have enlisted in the British Army, but he would have lost his U.S. citizenship. And, I mean, young men have always, they listen to the older men. It never seems that old guys ever talk about the horrors of war. They talk about the glory and how to fight, and young men believe it, and they go off. When they come back, those who do usually go, most of them don't think it was worth a damn. But I think because we're a species like that, I think the entire European continent was militaristic because of their colonies. I mean, British was practically a constant war for 80 years.
And they were at the height of their empire. They were watching Germany build up a navy that might threaten their access to that empire. So you've got economics going on there and human nature, Jack, Chris is saying. What do you say, Jack?
Well, this is a view that I remember in the 1960s, Robert Ardrey wrote a book about this, arguing that war was just rooted in the human condition. But, you know, my own view is slightly different. I mean, yes, the people that commit murders are the same people that go to war, and there's these awful things that individuals do. But I think Arnold Toynbee, really, who fought in the First World War, had it right when he said that Pierre and Fritz don't go to war. France goes to war with Germany. That nationalism is the bane of history, of modern history, it seems to me. And nationalism, if it were just this all bad thing, you know, propaganda, mm-hmm. and so on, well, we could say we could get through it, but it's not all propaganda. There's something else in it, attachment. And Dick Diver, the hero, the protagonist of Scott Fitzgerald's great novel, Tender as the Night, takes a trip to the Somme battlefield, and he's looking at it. And he gets to this idea of nationalism is also has to do weirdly with love. He writes, you had to have a whole soul sentimental equipment going back further than you could remember to fight here. You had to remember Christmas and postcards of the crown prince and his fiancée and little cafes in Valence and beer gardens in Unter den Linden and weddings at the Marie and going to the Derby and your grandfather's whiskers. This, the Somme, was a love battle. There was a century of middle-class love sped here. All my beautiful, lovely, safe world blew itself up here with a great gust of high-explosive love.
Wow.
He's saying, of course, that it's these attachments to the memories, going to the Derby, seeing a ball game with your father, standing up for the national anthem, feeling your heart soar.
Well, who's ever going to do away with those? Those are baked into us.
Baked in.
But do they have to be turned toward war? I mean, you know, Chris argues we would have had Hitler anyway. I mean, the case you're making is no, the century might actually have looked substantially different. I mean, wasn't Hitler wounded at the Somme? I mean, without the anger, the reparations of World War I, we're told, we might have had a different Germany. Certainly it's hard to imagine Hitler without World War I.
It's unimaginable. I mean, the two things, you know, World War I was the cause, I mean, unquestionably of World War II and its repercussions. And I show how it wasn't merely the Allied blockade of Germany, which effectively starved a generation of Germans. It was what happened after the armistice and how the Allies, to squeeze the Germans just that little bit, to coerce them to sign that hated document at Versailles, widened the blockade even to the Baltic so that famine, I mean, starvation really almost got to the point of famine in Germany. And what happened? Well, you know, the idea was that the blockade was like the anvil of the war. Well, the children on the anvil, who lost their teeth, whose bones broke from rickets. Those children were the strong, when they grew up, were the strongest voters for the Nazi Party in the 1932 election. Germans from 18 to 30 gave 42% of their vote to the Nazis in a multicolor candidate party field. And why? Because the Nazis offered them the solidarity that had been torn from them as children, and some of the warmth and feeling of protection, and above all, someone to hate and blame for what had happened to them.
Larry in Hartford, Connecticut. Larry, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Jack Beatty.
Hello, thank you. I've been listening and finding a little bit lacking discussion of some of the economic issues, the political economic issues, which nowadays come to the fore, not just as a matter of history, but even current issues. I would say you don't have to be a Marxist to talk about the old style imperialism that carved up Africa and was involved in World War One and so on. Mm-hmm. And know also that in film and drama, the depictions of how the working class, ordinary people suffer from war, while, of course, some benefit is shown in films, showing workers, for instance, in a mine beneath the French-German border in World War One, and how they had in common their basic interests. Even today, the movie Sherlock Holmes, all of it shows that shouldn't we in this program pay more attention to some of the issues of capitalism, economics, imperialism, not so much because of history, but because we even see it now with conflicts over oil, mineral rights, and so on. And so therefore, rather than saying that war is inevitable, why not look at some of the basic economic conflicts over markets, which unfortunately wind up in so much pain and suffering over the economic benefits that some receive from war.
Larry, let me take it to Jack. Economic interests, Jack, and systems there, Larry raises.
Well, this was the purport of a pamphlet that Lenin wrote in 1916 on imperialism, that it was the, you know, rivalry for territory and raw materials that brought on this war. With all due respect to Larry, I can find no evidence of that. I have a chapter on imperialism, on French imperialism in Morocco. And there was a mirage there of, oh, we'll get the iron ore and we'll get... But really, this was all about prestige. And France was desperately trying to compensate itself, its, as it were, to restore its amour propre for the debacle of 1870, for losing to Germany in that war. And they went abroad to find some sort of solace, you know. They couldn't conquer the Germans, but they could conquer lesser peoples without artillery. And boy, did they go at it with a vengeance. And it was these issues, I think, of prestige and standing, almost cultural, psychological matters, that at least in the French case drove their expansion, a kind of compensatory aggression. We can't go back. We can't take Alsace-Lorraine back. The Germans have it. But by God, we'll get Indochina.
But the British, I mean, just take that. They had, yes, an empire of pride, but it was also an economic empire that they were, I guess, thinking of defending around the world.
Oh, indeed, indeed. But, you know, when historians tote it all up, the empire cost more than it brought in. It brought in a great deal of swagger and psychic capital and a feeling of, you know, the sun never sets and so on. And certainly there were economic benefits, and certainly the city of London benefited. But it's very hard for me to see that economic imperialism drove the war. For example, the German expansion, what did they get out of the Navy? A few miserable islands in the South Pacific, some barren atolls. That's all they got for these millions of marks spent on their Navy. Nobody went abroad from Germany, practically. So there's a lot of, you know, the Lenin view has hung in the air. I just don't think the evidence is there for it.
Jack, what about the U.S. road into World War One? And you describe it going through Mexico, and I think not without economic interest. The U.S. looking really interested in Mexican oil back in the day, and then Pancho Villa and all the rest taking the U.S. to war?
Yes, you know, strangely enough, my chapter is called The President and the Bandit, and I tell what was happening in the United States in the spring of 1914, which was two things: Woodrow Wilson's decision to arm the rebels, Pancho Villa against the dictator in Huerta in Mexico City, a hugely controversial decision. And armed
the only time, you write, that the U.S. ever armed rebels against rulers in Latin America.
Well, I believe it is the only case that we armed a peasant revolution there. And it was to Wilson's great moral credit that he saw the oppression of this, and he even suspended the idea of free elections. He said, no, this thing has got to be fought out to the bitter end. Whole single men own whole provinces there. That's a great structure of wrong, and it's got to come down. And he even saw in Villa the lineaments of the next president of Mexico. Well, he was disabused of that quickly enough. But it is the case that when he intervened in Mexico in April 1914, not only aiding the rebels, but intervening in Veracruz, sending in the Blue Jackets and the Marines to prevent a shipment of arms from reaching the dictator, it was when he intervened that he no one could have guessed that he was plunging the United States into a stream of events that in April 1917 would sweep it onto the stage of world history, because no other great power would follow so improbable a path to belligerency. The U.S. entered the European war through Mexico.
Why? How, Jack? Give us the short description of that path.
Well, as you know, Villa finally turned against, and the president had their breaking of the ways. Mm-hmm. The president recognized the other side in the other rebel group. And Villa raided Columbus, New Mexico. The president, Wilson, sent General Pershing after him in the punitive expedition. Mm. And the Carranza, the ruler of Mexico, appealed to Germany to help. He said, please help us. The imperialists are coming down. And I'll give you a submarine base if you... And of course, the Great War was going on. We just weren't in it. And when the Germans replied through the Zinnemann telegram, sure, you can have a little. You can have New Mexico back if you fight with us. If you come with us, Mexico, you can have some of Texas. You can have, you know, this fantasy vision.
Watch out.
When this was publicized, and it was the greatest intelligence coup in history, the British got it and gave it to us. Got it from the wires and gave it to us. That event, even more than the Germany's announcement of unrestricted submarine warfare in January of 1917, that event in March of 1917, the publication of that telegram, mm-hmm. as the Literary Digest put it in a headline, Zimmerman unites the United States.
And pretty soon we were over there. Stephen,
yes.
Stephen in Providence, Rhode Island, you're on the air, Stephen. Our time is short.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to thank Jack for addressing a problem of inevitability. Because when something becomes inevitable, then you can forget it. You put it in a filing cabinet and you can forget it. And that annoyance at forgetting led me to actually walk down the entire Western Front and write a book about it called Back to the Front, in an attempt to see if the land itself had forgotten the war. And of course, it had not forgotten the war. You know, if you're wandering through Flanders or Picardy, the fields look perfectly normal. But the minute you go into the copses where they allowed the trees to grow back up, the trenches are still there. Mm-hmm. The land is lunar. It's awful. So you have this Western Front that snakes down through France. There's a sad necklace of memorials and graveyards. But the land itself has not forgotten the war.
And the scars are still there. Stephen, our time is so short, but I appreciate your sharing that. Jack, if it had somehow been dodged, what do you imagine of the 20th century and how it might have been different?
Well, let's take one scenario, the scenario that because the British are tied up in Ireland, they can't send their army to the continent, and Germany wins that war opening battle and wins the war, in effect. What would happen? Well, Neil Ferguson outlines this picture of, well, we'd have had an early version of the European Economic Union under German hegemony. And of course, it's under German hegemony today. Mm. And it would have been a fairly benign matter after a while. The occupation of France would have relented and so on. Well, that's one happy picture. But, you know, historians object to that. They say, wait a minute, Neil Ferguson, if defeat produced fascism and in Germany, why wouldn't it have done the same in France? And of course, there's a counterfactual for you. And if you look in France, you see plenty of proto-fascists then, this Action Française, this right-wing group that came up, sprang up around the Dreyfus Affair, was a powerful, sort of proto-fascist group. Who knows what would have happened?
I think I'd rather have it in French hands than German, Jack.
Yeah.
All things considered, oh, if only, if only. And I guess your message here as well, Jack, don't leave it to the coteries. People, get involved in these decisions.
Yes. War and peace is too important to be left to the diplomats, and the democratization of foreign policy remains an almost moral imperative.
Jack Beattie's new book is The Lost History of 1914, Reconsidering the Year the Great War Began. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jack, thank you very much. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.